There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hail and well met, traveler. Welcome to the tavern. Did you know this is the place where more than half of the greatest adventures in history have begun? But before those adventurers took their first steps, they watched and calculated who would join their party. Why, look over there. There's a mighty barbarian from the Frozen Lands. Strong, mighty, full of honor and wisdom. I happen to know that one. They go by Matt Rossi. And look over there to the right. That woman working away on her mechanical dog. She's cunning, witty, and I've seen her bounce more than her fair share of ne'er-do-wells out of here before I can even blink. I happen to know that she goes by the name Liz Harper. And me? Oh, my name's Joe Perez. And I'll be your tavern keep. Welcome to Tavern Watch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Tavern Watch. I'm one of your... well, podcast NPCs, Joe Perez, one of several tabletop enthusiasts on the site, and I'm joined with my wonderful co-hosts today, Matt Rossi and Liz Harper. How are you doing today, guys?
Hello, hello.
Life is misery, but let's talk about role-playing games instead of talking about life.
This is why Matt is a cult leader in my cyberpunk game. Anyway.
Let's do checks out.
Yeah. We are going to be talking today all about, well, one D&D, or D&D in general, because that is sort of the new big thing that's been happening. And there's actually a lot going on there and a lot to discuss. And while it is only in playtesting right now, it is something that is we should be taking a look at and giving feedback so that we can help the product become something that we want it to be as we move along. There is also some other topics here that we want to cover, particularly, Matt, you brought this up and I want you to take lead on it. So what just happened with Spelljammer?
Okay, so I've been pretty vocal in my like for the Spelljammer setting. I thought it was a really good product. I'm really happy with it. But I did notice the Hatter Z in Spelljammer have kind of it's a weird inclusion. I don't know how to break this down to people. Basically, the Hatter Z are essentially the victims of colonialism to the point where they're actually magically uplifted via it.
Yeah.
And their entire racial history is rooted in this narrative of, you know, people came from space and taught them civilization. It's like if Eric Von Daniken wrote a D&D supplement. Is kind of what it's like. And I knew that because it was part of the original Star Frontiers. But one of the things I've noticed as I've gotten older is that all the stuff you liked as a kid, ends up having some stuff in it. And you're like, oh, I did not notice that, or I didn't remember that. Oh, that's bad. And the how does he thing is one of those things. And it, as they put out a statement, there was a lot of outcry, not just on Twitter, everywhere, like, you know, forums, people in stores, everywhere. I went to the local gaming store, which I don't do very often, quite frankly, because it's downtown Edmonton, and I currently live in the arboreal tundra of the Northlands, aka North Edmonton. So it's a bit of a trip. But I was in there looking at other stuff, and somebody, a dude in his 50s, so, you know, about my age, was like going, you know, I don't understand all the outcry. And somebody, and like one of the clerks, who was a woman much younger than him, looked at him and said, because it's racist, Jim. And that is the outcry. It is a racist trope. And they've, you know, Wizards has realized, oh, this was originally the origin from the 80s. And we probably should have.
Yeah.
Yeah. We probably should have not included it. In retrospect, we should have looked at this more carefully. Go ahead.
One thing I find really interesting is that the racial description for the Hadozi in the playtest content did not include any of this.
That's
it
true.
Was.
Yes.
And, you know, that's not just like it's normal for them to add a bunch of stuff after the playtest, like a bunch of story stuff. And most of the races are, the description at least, is exactly the same as the playtest content, which was published months and months and months before the book. So what I'm wondering is, how did we go from the playtest content to what we have in the book, which is like,
yeah, which is hard to, there's no way to know how this ended up. One possibility is simply that the people doing the playtest thing handed in their, you know, their form. And then someone was like, oh, this is kind of dry, and went back to the original source material and just lifted it, because they own the original source material. Yeah. So I can imagine them doing that, but it does seem odd that they put the Hadazi out. This could have been a case of somebody who was involved in the playtest going, ooh, okay, I don't like that. And then, you know, hoping, you know, I'll just take it out here and hopefully that will just, it'll progress forward. I don't know. I wasn't there. But regardless, yeah, I mean, it is something that really needed to be looked at before the book came out.
It is so weird that no one thought of this when Wizards of the Coast has been making a really significant push to diversity. Did you not have anyone with semi-modern sensibilities reading this?
I honestly don't know.
I actually, I'm wondering if part of it is the speed. We talked about this when Greg was on the show too. There is a certain new cadence for every product that Wizards is putting out now. Right. And you can't maintain that speed without mess ups happening, right? Like, things are going to be missed, because if you're putting out a new book every 3 months, even with extended playtest, like, I'm not trying to hand wave it. I don't want to make that perfectly clear, because it never should have happened in the first place. But I could see a world where stuff like that gets missed, you know, because they are rushing to production and maybe not proofreading or copy reading like they should, or at the same quality that they should.
Although, let's make this point too.
But they also, they can afford to do it.
I'll just say this much. I've seen books that I've literally spent years in development and editing. Years. That have had plenty of time. Still have big errors and things like this included. Just because, you know, you look at the same document over and over again and you stop processing it. If you're looking for errors, You're looking for them, but you're on one level. You're not doing the reading of comprehending what does this say and what does it mean. I'm not saying that this shouldn't have been. This should absolutely have been caught, but I can understand that it wasn't caught, because these people, again, as Liz pointed out earlier, she's like, don't they have anybody with modern sensibilities? And in some cases, the answer is no. A lot of the people involved. You look at the names of the developers on this game. A lot of them are people who hearken back to the original release of Spelljammer. To them, this stuff is, they've already seen this 100 times. It doesn't even register to them, oh, wait a minute. Chariots of the Gods was actually bad. This idea is actually racist.
This isn't a typo. This isn't an it's error. This is, someone took the 2-paragraph racial description and replaced it with like a 4-paragraph racial description
Yeah, from an older thing that is really not good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
absolutely.
I mean, can I? I want to take a minute and like read the original playtest description versus like the description that actually got printed.
Go for it.
Which is, so the original is, Hedozis are people with simian features that long ago adapted to live amongst the tall trees of their homeworld. They're natural climbers with feet as dexterous as their hands, even to the extent of having opposable thumbs. Membranes of skin hang loosely from their arms and legs. When stretched taut, these membranes enable a Hedozi to glide. The first Hedozis were hunted by large natural predators. To survive in this hostile environment, they developed an instinctual sense of community. Today, the same instinct compels many Hedozis to cultivate friendship, knowing there is safety in numbers. That's like, that's a shortish description, but we have had shorter descriptions of races.
And they replaced, what they replaced what was released with was not much larger than that.
I think it was like about twice as long.
No, I'm talking about the updated one, the one that they just released as part of the errata, right?
Yeah. Like, so here's what actually wound up in the book. The first Hedozis were timid mammals, no bigger than house cats. Hunted by larger natural predators, the Hedozis took to the trees and evolved wing-like flaps that enabled them to glide from branch to branch. Several hundred years ago, a wizard visited Yazir, the Hedozi world, with a small fleet of spell-jamming ships. Under the wizard's direction, apprentices laid magic traps and captured dozens of Hedozis. The wizard fed the captives an experimental elixir that enlarged them and turned them into sapient bipedal beings. The elixir had the effect of intensifying the Hedozi's panic response, making them more resilient when harmed. The wizard's plan was to create an army of enhanced Hedozi warriors for sale to the highest bidder. But instead, the wizard's apprentices grew fond of the Hedozis and helped them escape. The apprentices and the Hedozis were forced to kill the wizard, after which they fled, taking with them all remaining vials of the wizard's experimental elixir. With the help of their liberators, the Hedozis returned to their homeworld and used the elixir to create more of their kind. In time, all Hedozi newborns came to possess the traits of the enhanced Hedozis. Then, centuries ago, Hedozis took to the stars, leaving Yazir's fearsome predators behind. In addition to being natural climbers, Hedozis have feet that are dexterous as their hands, even to the extent of having opposable thumbs. Membranes of skin hang loosely from their arms and legs. When stretched taut, these membranes enable Hedozis to glide. Hedozis wrap these wings around themselves to keep warm.
Yes.
Yeah. You know what this feels like to me? This feels to me like the second one was actually the first one.
Yeah.
And then they decided they were going to change it, made the change, got the change in the playtest documents, and didn't actually use the changed version when they were printing the book.
So I think regardless of though of whether whatever the case is of how it made it out there, it's a problem that it made it out there, right? Like that's
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
It should not have happened.
And the interesting thing about it is this is also part and parcel with a bunch of other problematic stuff that sort of is baggage that comes with Dungeons and Dragons as well. There's a lot of content that is, I mean, it's older content as races. Matt and I will talk about like a bunch of stuff that we love from back in the day and like some older books that we have and older box sets that we have sitting on our shelves. But the truth is like a lot of that stuff is problematic at best.
Oh, you want to talk problematic? Here's one of the ones that I always think of. One of my favorite books when it came out, absolutely cornerstone of my understanding of the game, was a little book called, and this book came out in the 80s, Oriental Adventures.
Yep.
Okay. Oriental? That's the word we're using, guys? Really? And it came out again in 2002. They made a new version of it, and they still called it Oriental Adventures. And yeah, I mean, and the second one was really good as well, but there's like a lot of stuff in it that it, to me, it's simple as the fact that there's entire races of beings in D&D who are just plain evil, despite essentially just being humanoid.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, it's one thing to say that a demon is evil itself because it's a demon. You know, it is not a person. But when it's just, you know, oh well, goblins are all evil, vicious dog murderers. It's like, why? Exactly. Just because? So we can kill this baby goblin and it's fine. Oh yeah, absolutely. Stick away. This is really feeling racial essentialist, guys. And that stuff is in there and you have to confront it and you have to evaluate it. I feel like this is a case of a really big failure to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And Wizards has been trying really hard to do that. And I think 1D&D will actually give us a good example of stuff to talk about in terms of them doing that. So yeah, I don't feel like this was deliberate. I don't feel like this is anything near as bad as, say, some company that doesn't even have the intellectual rights to say, Star Frontiers, making the world's most racist version of Star Frontiers. But it is bad. And it absolutely is something that should have been corrected. I'm glad it was corrected. But yeah, Liz is right. It doesn't, it's like you had a perfectly good description. Why did you then break out the longer one that was worse? So yeah.
We should make it completely clear that Wizards of the Coast did issue an apology for this. Yes. And, you know, like a really explicit, we acknowledge we made a mistake and we apologize, which I think that's a great move to see a company actually take the time to do that. And in future printings of the book, this description has been edited to remove all of the weird racist colonial stuff. And in digital versions of the book, it's already gone. So,
and I should also
trying, but
and they should also call it. They do thank people for basically calling them out on their bullshit, right? Like, so it's one of those things where, like, when they make a mistake, they're grateful for the community for calling them out. They're grateful for having that conversation and having that stuff pointed out, unlike other companies that then double down on the mistakes, right? So I got to give them at least a little credit for that as well. Where,
yeah, I definitely,
and it was rather quick in their turnaround in the response to it too.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But I do think that we can then, I think we should move on to actually talking about 1D&D or D&D 1, as both Liz and I keep trying to call it.
I do the same thing.
It's because 1D&D.
Yeah.
Officially, it's 1D&D.
In so my I'll heart, probably, it's D&D 1.
I'll probably internalize that it's 1D&D as soon as they change the name for the release, and I'll have to start.
100%.
Or you know, D&D Series 1. I don't know.
So,
but we should talk about it. So
yeah, so D&D 1, like we mentioned, is the or 1D&D. See, I did the same thing. 1D&D is the playtest set for the what is essentially going to be an eternal version of the game. Right now, the history of Dungeons & Dragons is that it's been sort of parsed out into editions. There's, you know, the Dungeons & Dragons, Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, AD&D 2nd Edition, 3rd Edition, 3.5, 4, and now 5e. 5e has been one of the longer running ones and is the one that most people that have come to the hobby recently are familiar with. So now what they're looking to do is sort of, how do you evolve your game? How do you evolve this game that has so many live shows now, so much content that's produced around it, so many people that are playing the game now for, you know, maybe the first time, the largest player base that they've ever had in a Dungeons & Dragons, like, period, is now here. So how do you do that without alienating people? Because this is a problem that they ran into. And Matt and I have talked about this plenty, is that switch from 3rd edition to 4th edition, where players felt it was too abrupt of a shift and sort of, you know, I don't want to say fell off, but it wasn't as popular as it could have been.
Let me put you this way. There wouldn't be a game out that is basically evolved from 3rd edition if people had been happy with 4th edition. That's just a fact. Paizo wouldn't exist if people had all gone. The problem with D&D has always been this problem, and it's been this problem all the way back to the D&D AD&D split. When you put out a new edition of the game, if you don't change enough, there's no reason to do it. If this is still basically the same game, then why am I spending the money on new books to play it? I've already owned all this D&D stuff. Why am I buying your books again? But if you change it too much, the people who have been playing it already, they're like, I don't want to have to relearn all this.
Or the fact that I maybe have spent, you know, I'm looking at my shelf right now. That's what, 20, 30 books total.
Yeah.
$50 a pop, you know?
Yeah. And that's the thing is people have often said that role-playing games are the best bang for your buck of any purchase for entertainment. And they're right. Because you can use them for years. You can do all sorts of cool stuff with them. Yes, you're correct. It's a really good bang for your buck. But it's still a luxury hobby in terms of its pricing. And that's just always going to be there. So with the additions of D&D, when you see new additions come out, and this is historically accurate, like you can go back and look at the charts. They're all online. When you see the second edition of AD&D come out, at first there was a big bump. Mm-hmm. And they kept the bump going with the kits and so forth. But then there was a pretty steady decline. as a lot of people just said, no, I'm going to stick with original AD&D. I don't want to play the second edition of AD&D. And the way they got around that for third edition was by making it such a big release and making it so different that it felt like a completely new game. But it was enough of D&D to keep people going. There's still always a bump. There's always that period of some people come in and they buy the new book, so there's a bump. But then there's often a trough because the original, the previous version of the game that people had, they liked it and they're sticking with it. One of the things that in the hobby that's called being a grognard. And, you know, it's a reference to French mercenaries. This hobby started with wargaming, guys. There's some pretty nerdy stuff out there. But third edition managed at one point to be so omnipresent, have so many books, that it kind of made itself simultaneously incredibly popular and ubiquitous, and also very hard to actually play.
Because it required so much material to actively like keep up with everything.
It didn't really require it to keep up. I don't quite agree with that, but I think you're hitting on the truth of it, in that you never knew what somebody else at your table owned. Mm-hmm. And was going to say, well, this is an official Wizards product, so you should use it too. And it's like, dude, I don't have the second Dungeon Master's Guide, or I don't have Book of Nine Swords. I have no idea what you're even trying to get me to do.
I don't have Player's Handbook 6. What are you talking about? Yeah,
exactly.
I'm not joking.
No, he's not joking. When fourth edition came out, the fall off was real. Like this time it didn't get the bump because so many people were so resistant to getting more books when they'd already spent so much money so recently. Wizards was putting out third edition 3.5 D&D books until the very moment they dropped fourth edition.
I think there's some other factors too that need to be taken into account with it as well too. So D&D third edition was everything that Matt said is absolutely accurate, and it was a very ambitious product, and I think we need to keep that in mind moving forward. Fourth edition came out at the height of MMOs. When MMOs were everywhere and omnipresent, video gaming was sort of becoming more mainstream. This is during the time period of the Night Elf Mohawk commercials and, you know, William Shatner doing commercials for World of Warcraft and Lineage 2 coming out and City of Heroes. And
I'm going to jump in with something here that's related to this.
Mm-hmm.
I know this from a fact. I played D&D in the early part of the 2000s with the people who worked at Wizards of the Coast, and with people who ended up working at Paizo.
Mm-hmm.
One of my DMs was the main guy on Pathfinder. They were all playing World of Warcraft.
Yep.
I know this because I saw them all the time in game and we did dungeons together. So they were big into MMOs. They played the living daylights out of them. Everyone that was out.
Now, the reason I bring this up is because it's a time period thing too, that I think affected tabletop role playing in general at that time, because it wasn't just D&D that had a little bit of a lull, although it was with fourth edition. Other ones suffered as well for a lot of the same reasons. People who were getting their role playing fix on the tabletop were now starting to find it in virtual settings, for better or worse. There was the sort of a reverse pendulum swing as far as that went. Now, the reason I'm bringing this up is we're looking at D&D. I'm going to keep calling it D&D 1. It's going to keep happening. 1 D&D is now poised at another pivot point as far as general consumption is concerned, which is we have more digital tools and technology for content consumption on the tabletop space that has been growing exponentially for a number of years, ever since D&D 5th edition first released, but especially in the last couple years due to the nature of what's happened across the world and the necessity of those digital tools. And a lot of what they're dealing with here is sort of poising to springboard into taking effective control or use of those digital tools in an eternal format. So a lot of the stuff we're going to talk about, keep that in mind, because that does play a factor here with some of the changes and some of the things that they're going to be talking about moving forward. Fair to say?
I'm sorry? I couldn't hear what you just said.
I said, do you think that's fair to say?
I think that is pretty fair to say. Liz, you started D&D with 5th edition.
Yeah.
And you've played a lot online. You have a live game, right? I know you have an in-person game as well, but
not anymore. It's all digital.
So from your perspective, your experience of this, how have you seen it change in the time that you've been playing?
I mean, that's hard because I really have only been playing for a few years now, and I've only been playing in the 5e era. I really got started with Critical Role, which, you know, we've had just a giant emergence in the presence of games being played online. And I mean, we always think of Critical Role, that's like the 10,000 pound gorilla of D&D streams, but there are tons of D&D streams. Probably at any hour of any day, you could go to Twitch and find a D&D stream. You could go to YouTube and find a D&D play video that's been posted 5 minutes ago. It's everywhere. But in the time I've played, I haven't seen a ton of evolution, certainly not to the rules. There are some new sensibilities that I've seen coming out where Wizards of the Coast is really leaning into diversity and content written by people of color and minorities. So I feel like they're really trying to push the game that direction to try and give a 50-year-old game modern sensibilities. And that's kind of a tough transition, particularly, I mean, we're talking just a minute ago about Spelljammer, which was written in the 80s and has much earlier sensibilities. But I mean, rules-wise, one D&D is like kind of mind-boggling because I haven't seen any rules changes in the time that I've been playing. It's all been 5e.
Well, I mean, 5e did change Origin to the custom background. They did allow that partway through as well, right?
Yeah, that's true. Tasha's Cauldron of Everything came out a couple of years ago. That really felt like part of this sort of push towards diversity and inclusivity, because it was like, okay, well, what if I want to play an orc who's like a bookworm and they become a wizard? And it's like...
Same with Mordenkainen's, right?
Yeah. I mean, Mordenkainen's continued the Tasha's rules. Mordenkainen's took those rules and like codified them for every race. But,
I was just going to say, why don't we use the breakdown that Liz wrote?
I was going to let Liz take point on it. Since the first bullet point you have, I think, is actually relevant here. Do you want to go ahead, Liz, with what they're doing?
Sure. The one D&D playtest content we've gotten so far is it's not the whole game. We just have like a little piece of it, and it's all about character origins. And we do see things that we've seen in Tasha's Cauldron of Everything, in Mordenkainen's Monsters the Multiverse, and in some Unearthed Arcana that's come out over the past year or two. We're kind of seeing that more modern sensibility where you have a lot of choices. And of course, the first thing is race. You know, your character's race is key to your character.
It's the framework in which you build your character.
Yes, that's a good way of putting it. But it's no longer completely defines your character. It feels like a lot of that has moved into backgrounds. It used to be that your race defined your stats. And, you know, if you were an orc, you were always strong. And Tasha's Cauldron of Everything gave you control over that and said, well, if you're an orc, you can choose to put, you know, figure out how you want to do your own ability scores. You put 2 in whatever you want. You put 1 in another one, or you put 1 point in 3 things. And it's your choice. You can decide if your orcs spent their youth hitting the books and becoming a really smart wizard. Or you can say, no, my orc lifted weights and they're super strong. It's a choice. It's not completely defined by your race. But in 1D&D, they've completely removed statistics from race. Your statistics have no tie to your race. Which, I mean, that does remind me of Tasha's, where you have the choice. Your statistics are now tied to your background, which I think character-wise, story-wise, that makes a lot more sense. It's not the race you were born into. It's what you've spent time doing. You know, you could be an orc and you decided to be a carpenter. And yeah,
this town here is full of orcs who've lived in peace for hundreds and hundreds of years, picking flowers, and they're all massive scrolling death machines. Why are they all so big? You have no idea how dangerous these apples are. No idea. So yeah, I got you there.
It's also funny that you mentioned that, because like one of the things that 5th edition had that I'm not sure people realize it had was backgrounds that, for better or worse, generally didn't give you much or were often forgotten by players.
Yeah. Like,
how many times have I can count on one hand how many times I've had a player call on their folk hero background in a current 5e generation. Right.
Yeah.
I did always make sure to take a background, and I usually took a background more for the skills than the special ability that it gave, because it was usually like one of them was like, you can get people to let you sleep in their barn. And it's like, Woohoo! I'm going to use that all the time.
Which doesn't sound like a big thing, but when you have no money to pay for an inn, yeah, of course. Yeah,
but it really but comes down to how often does this come up?
Exactly. So making it more central to the statistics, or at least how it affects your character build, I think makes more sense, because that's what people use backgrounds. Like, literally, that's what Matt just said, right? Like, he uses backgrounds to get skills out of it. So I thought that was really good. And didn't they also get rid of half races as well, Liz?
Yes, that's the other big racial news, is that, you know, you can no longer, there's no longer a half orc. There's no longer a half elf. Those aren't specific races, but instead that doesn't mean you can't play a half race of what, but it's now it's whatever choice you do. It's like, okay, my character's mom was an elf. My character's dad was a human. I'm a half elf, but it's not defined in the book the way it is now. You basically, you choose what your parents would have been. And then you say, okay, I'm going to be, you know, you like pick, I want to take the stats of a human, or I want to take the stats of an elf. And to some extent, you can mix, to some extent, you can kind of mix and match stats. I think you can take, like, you could pick your speed from one or the other, but
or
I
your,
think
yeah, your size or what have you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Things like that. So you can mix and match
a little bit.
If your mom
was a
orc
and your dad was a gnome, you could be like gnome sized or no, I'm serious.
You'd be a gnome sized
orc. You can do that now. You can do half dwarf, half orc, or, you know, half elf, half dragonborn. You could do that.
So I gotta
jump in though, because there's something in this that I don't like. The Ardling.
That is
you already have the supernatural
beings born
on the upper planes or have one or more ancestors originated there. You've got them already. They're called Aesimar. Just use the Aesimar. If you want to have some Aesimar have beast heads, fine. But, oh, this irritates me. This is feedback. Don't do this. You can have Ardling be a kind of Aesimar. You don't have to have the Ardling just show up and now we're the half divine ones. No, it's silly. It's silly, guys.
Okay, I should clarify that the section on races only adds one new race, the Ardling, and it doesn't include a lot of races, which I feel like is just because this is playtest content. They're kind of getting the basics. Yeah, you know, human, dragonborn, dwarf, elf, gnome, halfling, orc, tiefling.
I do like that they make orc, though. It's finally in one of these books. It's canon orc.
Not half orc, orc.
Yeah, not half orc, orc. You can play an orc. Because basically the half-orc was their kludge get around to let people play orcs while still leaving orcs as evil. And it's like, you know, you can have orcs as a threat in your campaign and a danger that have to be fought off. And they don't all have to be evil. Like, orc babies don't have to be naturally evil just because the orcs are attacking you. Because in real life, humans have been attacking other humans for generations without, you know, every human is inherently evil. So... yeah, I do like that they got rid of that, and I do like how they're handling the mixing and matching thing. I saw some people get a little twee about it, but in general, I think that the racial changes in 1D&D, I'm still trying to call it that, are good changes, and the background changes. Liz, can you talk about the backgrounds? Because I wanted to talk about those, but I want you to get to talk since you wrote this bullet list.
Well, I'll give kind of the rundown and then you can talk more. Backgrounds are, you know, they're kind of like they are now. They're where your character comes from, what they've been doing with their youth, what their trait is. But ability scores have now been moved to backgrounds. You pick your ability score bonus based on your background, +2 to one stat, +1 to another. You have two skill proficiencies, one tool proficiency, one language, one first level feat. And yes, every background now includes a feat. We'll get more into feats later. Mm-hmm. And some starting equipment that's valued at 50 gold pieces, which the starting equipment used to be mostly class and a little background. So I don't know if there's going to be any starting equipment tied to class anymore or if they're just moving it over here. I don't know. Either one could make sense.
I'm trying to remember how much the starting value is 50. Currently. So, yeah,
it is 50 gold pieces worth of stuff.
Yeah, so I don't really see how they're going to have equipment in class and background. Again, this is playtest document, so they might change it around later.
Yeah. Well, I think it used to be most of your equipment came from your class, and you'd get, like, a couple of things from your background. Like, you'd have a gaming set.
Or your tool.
Based on your... Yeah, something like that. Small stuff.
I like almost everything about this, as long as they keep it that you don't necessarily have to adhere to a background in order to get X stat distribution and allow you to put your plus two and plus one anywhere, because that was really the best part about Tasha's, right? Like, is it didn't really matter what you picked for anything. You can just put your plus two and your plus one wherever you wanted. The one thing that I would like to see added to this is a third option, which Matt will probably remember from third edition, was the option to have three plus ones.
I think they had the three plus ones in Tasha's, didn't they?
They did have it in Tasha's, but it's not explicitly mentioned here.
Correct.
Okay, yeah. So hopefully they do bring that back. The three plus ones, that's essentially the variant human from current 5e. And I think it's a good rule, generally speaking, to get three plus ones, because D&D scores are weird in that you takes 2 points in a stat to bump you into the next level of bonus.
Mm-hmm.
Like a 17 and a 16 and a 17 have the same bonus. But if you have a 17 and you put a one into it, you'll go up to 18. Whereas if you have a 16, you'd have to put two in it to get up to 18. So there's periods of time where it's actually advantageous to have a plus one instead of a plus two. You'll go up, you'll get the same benefit that you would have from a plus two in a different stat without. Yeah. So I think in general that is a good move, and I would like to see it. I do also like that you can pick a pre-made background or customize your own, that's actually going to be in the rules now. That's another Tasha's thing, isn't it?
I think it is.
Yeah. I do like.
Yeah. I mean, so I think that means you'll be able to customize your stats however you want, basically just like you can now with Tasha's rules.
But the one that they have, there's a list here that Liz wrote out. The ones for playtest are the Acolyte, the Artisan, the Charlatan, the Cultist, the Entertainer, the Farmer, Gladiator, and Guard, Guide, Hermit, Laborer, Noble, Pilgrim, Sage, Sailor, and Urchin. I there's some that I would like to see in here that aren't here now, but they've also, one thing we should talk about is that when she says one first level feat in here in the document, there are now levels to feats, and that's going to come up. We're going to talk more about that when we get to feats, but basically when you get a background, there's certain fundamental, like first level feats, the ones that kind of like start you on your path type feats that they've built in. And that's a really nice change. I think, I actually think it works pretty well. What do you guys think about that one?
I think feats are really interesting ways of customizing your character right now, but there's a real barrier to entry of getting a feat. So you wind up not getting them until later levels, if you get them at all, because most D&D games, you know, you don't get to level 20 where you have all of your stats finished and perfect and you can pick up like three or four feats. I don't know.
This is a... Go ahead. Sorry.
As it stands now... I believe variant human gets a feat just as a racial perk, and yes. humans will still, as it's written in the playtest document, humans still get an extra feat. But other than that, you could get your first feat at level 4, but you would have to choose, do I want stat bonuses to increase my stats and make me better at everything? Or do I want a feat that makes me better at a specific thing and may or may not provide stat bonuses? And that can be a hard choice, particularly at lower levels when your stats may not be very high.
Yeah, and that's why I think it's good to have feats be built into the background.
Yeah, because I like it.
You're going to take one, you know, because it's free. It's not costing you a stat bonus.
I also think that feats need to become more interesting. And this might be a hot take and for some folks out there, but I think the problem that 5th edition had versus like 3rd edition, 3rd and 3.5, the feats were a lot more varied and a lot more interesting. They did come with prerequisites in some cases. Some of them had level requirements. Some of them had other feat requirements. Like you had to essentially like talenting and WoW, right? You had to take this talent to get to another talent. But it felt like a little more customizable with your character. Like you could have a party of 4 clerics and each one feel wildly different. And while there was some things to help differentiate in 5th edition now, feats was not one of them.
Feats are very treated like, well, if you really want to use these, you can.
Unless it was like very specific things. Like if you were a gunslinger and took the gunslinger specific feats, because why wouldn't you? Because they were developed specifically for that class in mind as a supporting feature to it. So like,
yeah, but again, it's like, you know, you see all the gunslinger is very much not part of the main rules.
Exactly.
And then they do that. There's this whole thing in the 5e Player's Handbook about how this is optional. Your DM may not even allow you to do this. You may just have the stat bumps and that's it. And I think Liz is on to something here. And I would say that if anyone is listening to this and saying, hey, what feedback do they have on feats? Uncouple feats from stat bonuses.
Yeah, agreed.
If there's a stat boost, that should just be for stat boosting, and feats should not be on that track. It shouldn't be, I have to choose between +2 to like a bonus to a stat or a feat, because they shouldn't be considered the same thing. They're different things. Stat boosts, as Liz pointed out, are universal ability. Like, I'm a fighter, I get an extra +1 to hit because I boosted my strength 2. That's universal. That's, I will be using that for almost everything I do.
Now, there's
a feat just gives you something. So I think they should be separated.
There's a design thing that we're going to probably talk about when we get to the rules change that I think actually feeds into this as well, because I think it's a perceived failure of fifth edition. So in fifth edition, like, we're talking about feats and stats sort of being on the same level or being sort of like bundled together. And I think part of the problem with that is stats in fifth edition became very, very important because stats became the only way to really increase a lot of the things your character did, whether it was your survivability or whether it was the damage you do, unless you get like some ridiculous magic weapon, at least early on. Right. So like, even if you're in full plate, having other stats that like give you constitution bonuses, make you more of a tank, or if you're playing a monk, you want to raise your wisdom or your dexterity so that you're more survivable on the front lines. And it became so integral to your character surviving because the lower levels of fifth edition are brutal. You can kill a player party with a brown bear at level 1. If 6 players, level 1 can die to a brown bear. Mm-hmm. Power skew is very heavily in favor of the dungeon master, with the most basic enemies until you get much higher level and things are balancing out. But at that point, you want feats to survive that bumper, right?
Yeah.
Or stats.
This way, there's a way that this happened to me. I was running a group for my wife and one of her friends and her friend's child. And I had them fighting one kobold, and that kobold would have killed them all.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he seriously, like, I rolled like 320s. On that, I'm like, what is happening with this kobold? He's a death machine. I did not intend this to be. They were going to capture him and interrogate him. Now he's literally kicking their butts. I had to make the kobold take they offered him milk and he became their friend. And I had to let that happen because otherwise he was going to kill all 3 of them. And he just didn't stop rolling 20s. I don't, you know, now that's, it's a bit of an edge case, but that can happen in fifth edition. First level characters don't have a lot of gas in the tank. You don't really even get a lot of classes don't even get their signature. I'm this kind of whatever until third level. I think warlocks and clerics being big exceptions. I can't remember all if there anyone else is, but sorcerers might be too, right?
Yes. Sorcerers are level 1.
Yeah. But so, yeah, I definitely agree with that. I think that feats need to be taken off of that kind of thing.
And well, I think
what,
sorry, go ahead.
One thing I will note is the playtest document only lists level 1 feats right now, but none of them have any stat bonuses tied to them.
Yeah, that's true. Except tough.
Except Does for it? Tough. Yeah, it's
tough. It gives you hit points.
Okay.
But bundled in there, and that's actually what I was going to do, is I'm going to read off the list. So bundled in the playtest, you have alert, crafter, healer, lucky, magic initiate, musician, savage attacker, skilled, tavern brawler, and tough, which are all first level feats, as Liz pointed out. Tough being the only one that is tied to stats because, well, it's making you tougher. The rest of them give you other bonuses, whether it's an extra skill proficiency, whether it makes your attacks hit a little bit harder, whether it makes you better at improvised weapons, but their start or you can reroll dice or whatever the case is, or it gives you access to magic. The core group of this, though, looks like these level 1 feats are sort of to give your character flavor and maybe a direction to build off of. Like, if you're building a tavern brawler, you might wind up going into feats that emphasize found weaponry or like turn yourself into essentially an action flick from the 90s. And that's where I think feats feel the best, because that's where they think they felt the best in third edition and other games that have feats. It feels the best when there are ways to customize your character to play how you want it to. And it seems like that's what they kind of want to do here. Minus tough, which I don't think will ever go away because hit points are hit points.
Yeah, basically, you know, tough is always a safe bet. Any class can make use of tough.
But I mean,
I think,
but it also means like you can have a fighter that has magic initiate. So you can have a fighter that you can, as long as you meet the prerequisites, or whatever they have the conditionals for, that can cast magic missile or something like that, like, or give you access to something that makes it a little more flavorful, a little more like a fantasy novel.
See, that I have a specific example on, because when I made my character to play in your other wheeled game, Joe, instead of taking a stat bonus at level 4, I took, it may have been magic initiate.
I think you did.
Because I wanted some spell casting, because I thought it was a good fit thematically for the character I'd built, who had been like raised in this magical cult worshipping this god. And I thought, you know, okay, it makes sense that she's picked up a little bit of like kind of dark cleric magic, but I was a rogue and my main attacks are all melee. And that was actually a big hit to the character. I mean, that was not the smart choice if you want to make a powerful character, but it was a better choice for flavor and characterization. And so that's not a fun choice to make.
Whereas if you can find the sweet spot that marries the two of those, making it a smart and fun choice, and something that lets you customize your gameplay and still feel effective, then you win. Like that's the winning combination right there.
Yeah.
So like precisely in these new rules, I could have taken magic initiate at level 1 and my character would have started out with this cultist background, probably, that's in the playtest rules, and have also had like immediate access to some magical spells that were in theme with the background.
Yeah. We haven't seen what they're going to do for classes yet.
No.
One of the things I hope they do is they bump everybody's subclass to level 1, because it's just, I understand the idea that they were going for, that you start a couple levels and you play as just the general thing. And then you pick up, this is the thing I was meant to be, but it ends up just being, you know, spend 2 levels waiting to do the thing you want to do. Considering all these changes, and they're good changes, I'm hoping, I really like the backgrounds remind me of a toned down version of some of the backgrounds we were seeing in like the Strixhaven book.
Yes.
Which those backgrounds were
I think too they were good. I think they were testing for, I think the Strixhaven ones were not only thematically appropriate for Strixhaven, which is a multi-universal school for wizards for Magic the Gathering, but it might have also been playtest or probing to see if people reacted to it favorably to look towards something like this, because they were, those backgrounds were really well received.
Oh, they're great backgrounds, but they're also very strong.
And they all included a specific feat with them.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And I think that is a good thing, that they're bringing feats into this. Let me see. What else we got here? There's a lot to talk about.
There is. Let me, like, as an example of the feats, I think the new feats add kind of more power. Like, these are things I can see myself actually using more often than the existing feat. Mm-hmm. Like, let me read out a new one and, like, the original one. Like alert is on, it's in 5e and it's also in the playtest document. The 5e version of alert is always on the lookout for danger. You gain the following benefits. You gain a +5 bonus to initiative. You can't be surprised while you were conscious, and other creatures don't gain advantage on attack rolls against you as a result of being unseen by you. You're going to get the initiative bonus, you know, kind of all the time whenever you're in combat, which is usually a lot. But the other two, you may not even notice those because, you know, maybe your DM throws stuff like this at you and maybe they don't, in which case you've got all of these cool abilities. They're just not that helpful. So in the playtest content, you have alert, which gives you initiative proficiency. When you roll initiative, you can add your proficiency bonus to the roll, which I like that a lot better because the other thing is that it's weaker at first if you take it at first level, but it will get stronger as you get stronger and your proficiency bonus gets higher. So you get a benefit that keeps getting better and grows with you.
Mm-hmm.
And the The other part of that feat in the playtest content is initiative swap. Immediately after you roll initiative, you can swap your initiative with the initiative of one willing ally in the same combat. You can't make the swap if you or the ally is incapacitated. And that's another cool thing. That's a thing you will use or could use every time you're in combat.
Whereas,
the previous version is like, maybe this will never come in useful. Maybe I'll forget I have this. It comes in useful so rarely.
But I'm already thinking of games we've had where like we've had the healer the person has built as a healer wants to go later on in the round and so has to save their action, loses out on a super high initiative, and the person that you want doing your opening in the combat, whether it's a rogue or the fighter or whatever, rolls poorly. And is going later on in the turn order where you could just, in this particular case, say, hey, you should go first and I'm going to go later and do cleanup when everybody gets hurt. And you can make that swap. You can be a little more tactical about it. It also sort of encourages more inter-party. I don't want to say inter-party play because you should already be doing that, but inter-party tactics of like discussing it and moving stuff around so that it gives players an advantage. Right. And that's, Matt brought this up, brings this up often, and I think it's very true in D&D, is in video game design, one of the things that some developers have talked about is it's not their job to kill the players, it's their job to lose convincingly, and it's kind of the same thing in D&D, and this lets players have more tools and be in more control of it, so you have an easier time losing convincingly.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to like cheat as much to lose.
Yeah.
And that's always good. But a lot of these feats are that way. She picked a really good one to do an example of, but the Savage Attacker one's nice just because it's pretty much the same as it always was, but it's still a nice first level feat. And it's no longer limited to, you know, orcs get this. It's, you know, anybody who wants to take it can get it. It's rooted in a background. So yeah, I'm overall pretty happy with the feat choices here.
Now, I think because we're getting a little long here in the tooth, I just want to start going into the rules that they displayed.
So many rules.
So I'm gonna read off some of these, and then we can hit on the ones that we want to talk about afterwards. So the rules changes that they've highlighted in the playtest right now is rolling a natural 20 on a d20 is an automatic success. Rolling a natural 1 on a d20 is an automatic failure. If it's not possible for a character to succeed, they shouldn't be asked to roll. We're going to talk about that later because I have feels. Critical hits are only available to physical weapons, not spells. Grapple, set speed to 0. Disadvantage on attacks except against the grappler. Can be dragged or carried, but grappler is slowed. Escape by rolling dex or strength. DC to break grapple is 8 plus strength modifier plus proficiency bonus of the grappler. That is actually a huge change. Incapacitated, you cannot take actions or reactions. Your concentration is broken and you cannot speak. And you have disadvantage on initiative rolls. Also kind of a big change right there. Inspiration, gained whenever you roll a 20 on a d20 or at the DM's discretion. Can only have one at a time. Slowed, moved at half speed. Attacks against you have advantage. You have disadvantage on dex saves. And spell types are now divided into arcane, divine, and primal.
That last one is actually a return from 4th edition.
It absolutely is. And I'm glad that they're doing that, actually, because I think it makes sense.
I want to talk about grapple before we do the whole thing about natural 20s and natural ones, because one thing you didn't mention, the way you initiate a grapple is different now too.
Oh, okay. What is it?
When you're making a grapple, I'm going to go to the actual document. So I make sure I don't give you bad information here, but, and of course it means I don't have to like get through this entire huge document. Come on.
Yeah, I do.
Here we are. When you make a grapple, You don't have to do the opposed check anymore. Grapples are an unarmed, it's just a comment of attacking. It's an unarmed attack. You just grapple. You roll to hit. So as a result, since they've changed it so you can use dexterity, and so they've changed it so it can be just an attack, monks are now grappling fiends. Monks can grapple people. I know it's in the thought about combat.
Okay, that's what I was asking because I didn't see it under the grapple section.
Yeah, go to the section that says that's labeled unarmed strike.
And as a result, that's how you can now do that. You can just attack with an unarmed attack and grapple somebody. And there's no, like, they don't get an immediate roll to get out of it. Either you hit them or you don't. If you hit them, they're grappled.
I will jump in to say it does still say that your bonus to hit with an unarmed strike is strength plus proficiency.
Yeah, I'm assuming that also converts to dexterity for
like it'll and so forth. It'll probably, when they break down into to features and stuff like that, I can't imagine it'll always be like that. But it is good to note right now that it is only strength. And there are size restrictions still on it as well.
Yeah, but
it has
still
to be same size or one larger, and you have to have an open hand.
The way this works now, if you had like a monk, right now monks do not want to grapple anymore. It's not the thing. They're not good at it. But with the rule switching it so you can use dexterity to break out or to, you know, keep from being broken out, this makes monks much better at grappling.
Monks are now
right up there.
I'll add again that escaping, the same thing. It's 8 plus strength plus proficiency
or
bonus.
Or not, dex, right.
No,
well, it doesn't say that. It does not say or dex.
Oh, the DC.
It says the DC to escape.
Yeah.
So you can roll dex to get out, but
it kind of makes sense.
It's strength based.
From a real world combat perspective, it kind of makes sense. I've done sword training and stuff like that in real life, and there is a one-handed sword technique where like you have an open hand in your other hand where like you grab somebody to try to move them around or use it as like deflecting or whatever. This leans more into that, and I can kind of see what they're going for, and I think it kind of makes sense.
My point here isn't to say that this is bad. I have some concerns with it, but I'm not saying it's bad. What I'm saying is it's very different.
Mm-hmm.
Because right now the way it works is if I want to grapple somebody, I have to get up there and make a grapple check, which they immediately have to make a check to avoid, like whoever rolls better. Now, that's taken out of this. You no longer have that situation. And if they basically allow monks to use their dex instead of strength for this, then monks are going to be grapple demons. It'll be almost, it's just going to be like, oh God, here comes a monk. I'm never going to do anything. I'm going to have this guy on me like Spider-Man. It's just something that I wanted to mention before we moved on to the changes to rolling, which I know Joe has thoughts on. So I'm going to let him go first. Liz, do you have something you want to say about it? Or do you want to let Joe go first?
No, go for it.
So I understand the idea of having, because right now in fifth edition, if you roll a natural 20, it's a critical success, and lots of things happen where if you crit with a spell attack, you crit with a regular attack, you get extra damage and all sorts of fun stuff happens. Rolling a 1 is not generally considered a critical failure in combat right now, because you can actually hit a skill point where a 1 is not an automatic failure depending on what you're fighting. In the current the rules that they're playtesting, a 20 will always succeed no matter what happens. And a 1 will always fail no matter what happens. My problem with that is every time you roll a dice, no matter what your skill level or level is, your character has a 5% chance to succeed or fail. And I do agree with the point of if the character doesn't have a chance of succeeding, they shouldn't be asked to roll. But I don't like the automatic failure portion of it really very, like, it doesn't seem very player friendly to me. And the reason I say that is because, and Matt and I have talked about this, and I went on a little bit of a Twitter rant about it. You can reach a level where you are so skilled at something that even a failure is a success, right? Like, or you're fighting something that's so derpy or dumpy that nothing is like, you're going to hit a noose. It's a slow moving pile of goo. You're going to hit it. You're not just going to completely throw your weapon all the way across a field when you're being charged by like at the speed of 5 feet around. Like, that's not a thing that's going to happen. These things are slow. So I kind of don't like where that's at. I can understand what they're trying to do and make it feel like there's more stakes maybe for the attacking. And so that you can't actually, you know, always succeed. There has to be some sort of thing. But one thing that I think they did really well in fifth edition is that's where monster traits came in, like those oozes that you could hit because they only had an AC of 8 and everybody in the party, even if they rolled a 1, had a +7 minimum to hit and would hit it. It didn't take damage from regular attacks. It didn't take damage from piercing or slashing or bludgeoning. It had to be magic or things like that. And it sort of balanced it out a little bit more to make it a little more, in my opinion, fantasy or cinematic. So I don't generally like that the ones automatically fail. Also, in the current edition, a 20 on a skill check does not mean you automatically succeed, which is where the second part comes in of you shouldn't be asked to roll if you can't succeed. And I agree with that. But I also don't think a 20 should automatically succeed no matter what. just don't ask the person to roll if they can't succeed.
Part of the problem is that people don't realize that a lot of times DMs are kind of pressured into letting people roll.
Mm-hmm.
People are like, well, I'm a bard. Like, let me roll to seduce that dragon. And you just kind of go, all right, go ahead. And then when they roll a 20, like, yeah, like, nope, didn't work. Because you know they can't seduce the dragon. The dragon is not attracted to human bards. But with this rule, if you don't have that option anymore. It takes away the DM option of letting the player roll their dice just to get them off their back.
Or sometimes just to make somebody feel good and participate, right? Like,
yeah, yeah. Because like, you don't... I'm letting you roll because you really want to roll. And I'm going to describe what happens next in as funny a way as I can make it out to be.
And,
like, you know, the dragon blinks for a couple seconds, bends down and goes, a little small for me, but I like the energy. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like stuff
you
can like
make
that.
It a thing. But I don't want to make it so that if he rolls a 20, that dragon is going to bone him.
And that's it. Know? Like, I feel like it sort of hems you in as a DM to not really have that wiggle room anymore. Because now the rules are hard coding. If a player rolls a 20, it works no matter what. Or if a player rolls a 1, it fails no matter what. There's no narrative leeway. So it's not a rule that I would personally use should it make it to live. Liz, how do you feel about this as a new-ish, or like, you're not a new player at this point. You've been playing for long enough. But as somebody who's been playing a little more recently than we have.
See, my feelings on it aren't as strong as either of yours. I can see, like, interesting storytelling possibilities with this as well. Like, it's an interesting story if you have, like, the fighter with an intelligence of 8 rolls on an arcana check and rolls a natural 20, and it's like, wow, you know, you could come up with like an interesting story on that. Like that
literally,
one in
that
a million
one book you read one time because you were bored silly actually mentioned this.
Yes, it mentioned exactly this. You accidentally picked up the wrong book at the library. You were looking for fighting techniques, and then you started reading this. And so, like, you could come up with some really funny story moments from that. But as both of y'all have said, it removes wiggle room. I also do kind of like the idea of critical fumbles, because I think, again, that opens kind of interesting story elements, because no matter how good you are at something, sometimes you could screw it up. You could have just tons and tons of experience with something and still you're having a bad day, you haven't had your coffee yet, whatever, you just, like, you mean to attack and you drop your sword.
I agree, so but it's the 5% that bothers me.
Yeah, so I think both of them offer interesting story possibilities, but it does feel like this should be an option, not a rule. Like, maybe put this in the book as, you know, you can just say, you know, if you...
Remember how you guys made sheets into like something you could or could not use? Make this into something you could say, now, as a possible house rule, you could do this.
Now, I was talking with a couple of our readers and listeners on Twitter about this. And there's an old thing from third edition that I think could, if they really wanted to go this route, it's a little cumbersome, but they could maybe try to find a way to make it a little more elegant. And Matt might remember this. It's the confirming crits and confirming fumbles.
Yeah, I knew you were going there.
Where, like, if you rolled a natural 20 or you rolled a 1, you then rolled the d20 and you had a 50-50 shot of it going, like, basically 10 or lower, it was a critical fumble or it was a regular hit, and a 11 or higher, it was just a normal miss or it was a critical hit.
It depends if it was a skill check or an attack.
I think that, yeah.
I remember for attacks, if you rolled a critical fumble, I think you had to roll, and if your attack would hit, if this roll would be a hit, it wasn't a critical fumble, but you still missed.
Mm-hmm.
And the same was true for critical success. If you rolled anything that would hit, now it's a critical hit. You did critical this person. Whereas if you rolled a 1 on this confirmation check, not a crit. So you just got a normal hit. And I could see that working. It is, however, sort of already baked into the rules with advantage and disadvantage. I don't know if they're going to want to do that. I don't see them wanting to put another mechanic like that in. And advantage and disadvantage are probably the cornerstone mechanics of 5th edition.
And I can see where they're trying to put that in here, too, with the inspiration being gained on whenever you roll a 20. Mm-hmm. But also, I am not the biggest fan of that, of having an automatic inspiration.
I don't mind having automatic inspiration, but I want it to not devalue bardic inspiration.
I also wanted to not devalue coordinating and working with the team of like your fellow players in the party for like positioning or things like that as well. Cause I think I personally think that that's sort of important, but also if you're already giving somebody an automatic critical hit on 20, no matter what they do, or critical success on 20, no matter what they do, does a natural 20 need anything else with it to make it more special? Like that, that's kind of my thought on it. Right.
I'm pretty sure like I'm more mellow on that. Liz, do you have any feeling on that one? Because there is something I want to talk about that isn't the inspiration thing.
I like this rule because how many times do you just forget inspiration exists in the game? How many times do DMs forget inspiration exists in the game? Like, I watch several game streams and like 90% of the time, no inspiration is ever handed out. And I mean, I think in our games, I can't think of a single time anyone has gained inspiration. And this gives you like a really reliable rule that says, okay, when something, you know, when you roll natural 20, something really great happens, you get inspiration. You're inspired by your success. You're kind of riding high on that success. And that does kind of make thematic story sense. And it's also something cool when you roll a 20, because right now, if you roll a 20 on like an Arcana check, it's okay, you're probably going to succeed the Arcana check, but it's like nothing cool and special happens because you did something really well. So I like having a consistent way to give it out. Does this rule need to exist? Does D&D even need inspiration, considering we have so many games right now that just don't use inspiration? That I don't know, but I do think it's kind of cool to have an extra effect on a natural 20.
Okay. I'm going to move to the one that I think really needs to be addressed. Critical hits are only available to physical weapons, not spells. I play physical characters almost exclusively. I'm playing a bard in the Witchlight game, and I like my bard. But generally speaking, I play physical characters. I don't like this rule.
Agreed.
I get why it exists. It can be pretty terrifying when, you know, a spell that already does a bunch of dice of damage suddenly gets a crit. But critical hits are only available when you make a weapon, you make an attack, when you roll to hit. So there's a penalty that can possibly keep you from hitting at all or doing anything. You can't get a critical fireball, I don't think.
Nope, you can't.
Because you can't roll in it. You don't roll an attack roll for fireball. So I don't feel like letting people crit with spells like, say, Eldritch Blast is bad. And I don't like the idea of it not being there anymore.
I agree, because from a spellcaster standpoint, like at early levels, at least in fifth edition as it currently stands, and we don't have the full breadth of spells for the new version that they've been talking about, but at early levels, spellcasters deal a lot more damage than physical combatants almost across the board. However, at about level, I think you get your second attack at, what, 6 when you're a physical fighter?
Five. Level 5 for fighters, and fighters, barbarians, and paladins. I think technically speaking, rogues,
Rangers get a second attack at 5.
I think for like rogues, it's not the same. Like, I think it's based on dual wielding, but they do get an offhand attack and then they use it.
Now, the reason I'm bringing this up is because at about 5th level, physical characters statistically, and I've seen this in like actual, like in the wild, start to outpace spellcasters, because spellcasters are still beholden to things like spell slots. And while they may have a very powerful spell, they may only have 1/5 level spell. And then once that spell slot's gone, it's gone. And then they start reducing their resources and they start to trail off. That's sort of the design of the class.
Well, it's not just that. There's another problem. Mm-hmm. Let's use the fighter as an example. And the reason that this is really noticeable with the fighter has action surge.
Yep.
Action Surge is so powerful that I have seen people advising like sorcerers and wizards to take a 3-level dip in like a 2-level dip in fighter. Just to get Action Surge. So you can cast your big spell and then another big spell. Because the spellcaster is only getting one action, and that one action they can only really cast one spell.
And
I mean, there's some edge cases where you could do like a cantrip and then a big spell, but in general, you're going to be doing, okay, I dump fireball in the group. Okay, most of them resisted it. I'm done. That's my round.
But also, it's particularly noticeable in longer combats too. And I'm not saying that I'm not saying that this is always the case, but it's interesting to me from an encounter design perspective, where if you have the big bad and a bunch of minions, those fights can take a while, and that can take more than a handful of turns. And if it takes more than a handful of turns, your spellcaster might be completely tapped and relying on cantrips to do their damage at range. Like you mentioned Eldritch Blast. Warlocks don't have a whole lot of spell points. So like Eldritch Blast is sort of their thing. And when you start getting to those higher levels, like at one point in time, and I'm using this as an example from my own personal experience, my gunslinger fighter was able to do 324 points of damage to an ancient black dragon in one round. Like it was level 16, 17 at the time, but like that's obscene. And the spellcasters couldn't even come close even when they crit. So like, I don't like taking it away from spellcasters unless there's something else to balance it out, which we haven't seen yet. So I don't like it, but I'm giving them the leeway to say, okay, what do spellcasters get instead? Do they get more spell slots? Do they get their own version of action surge as a feat? Do they get spell surge? Are the spells, do they hit a little bit more to make it average it out? And to Liz's point earlier, yes, most campaigns don't get to super, super high level, but if they get to middle levels, like they get to 10, 12, 14 in that range, it can feel bad to be a wizard or a sorcerer sometimes. What do you think, Liz?
I don't like it. I mean, what I feel like they're trying to do here is to give these physical classes something like extra special, something that makes their crits feel really cool and awesome, when spellcasters always have kind of spellcasters have a lot of flashy stuff. You know, you have a lot of options as a spellcaster usually. You have a bunch of different spells for a bunch of different situations. And if you're a fighter, you're going to go in, it's going to be like, okay, I'm going to hit it with my sword. Okay, I hit it. I'm going to hit it again with my sword. Okay, now my second attack. I'm going to hit it again with my sword. Okay, now action surge. I'm going to hit it again with my sword. Like, you know, there's that sort of sameness to it.
Sure.
And if you crit.
And that's why, yeah, that's why like subclasses like the Battlemaster are so interesting to people, because you can now say, I'm going to use blank strike, and now it's going to be a different kind of attack, and it kind of feels like you're casting spells with your sword. So yeah, I get you there.
Yeah, but if you're trying to give someone something special and you take something special away from someone else, that just doesn't feel good. That never feels good. But I do kind of feel like they're trying to make these physical damage classes feel like really cool and awesome and fun, and give them something special other than every turn you hit something with your sword. I mean, I'm kind of feeling that with the ranger I'm playing with y'all right now. Is like, okay, what am I going to do this turn? I wonder. I guess I'll try and hit it with an arrow. Okay, I'll try and hit it with another arrow now.
And this is where, like, this is where I would normally be advising people, like, and right now, because we're playing shorter sessions, like, it can sometimes feel like that when there is a combat, or if combat's the main focus. But there are other things like DMs can do, like, okay, instead of having stuff like that, have combat puzzles. Take the God of War route, where there's like combat's happening, but have other stuff that like a physical person can think to do aside from just hitting things with a board.
Yeah, you put in a couple of weird Drake type monsters and these things on the ground that you have to hit, and the party will adjust to them. Our final Weir's game was really good. I'm sorry. We did a great job there. I was very happy. But I mean, that's like one of the things that comes to mind is it would be kind of cool if one of the things sorcerers get that I've always liked is meta magic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I don't think it should just be a sorcerer thing. Quite frankly, I think every caster should have their own version of meta magic.
Well, one thing, let me just jump in briefly, is that it was either Tasha's or an Unearthed Arcana that added a meta magic feat that any spellcaster could take and get their own meta magic.
And I think I think that should definitely be something that goes forward. And I think that to a certain degree, every physical character should have maneuvers. Like if you are one of the things about playing the paladin that I've been really enjoying doing in when Joe's running our Weir's game is that I have this, I don't just have the, I hit it again. I have this thing. Like, do I want to use up one of my very few spell slots to smite this guy? And as a result, paladins kind of already have this thing where a crit is extra special to them because if a paladin crits, they are immediately going to bump a smite if they have one, because the smite damage will go up. Is smite considered physical weapons, not spells? Like, if you just gotten rid of smite crit?
You might have.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm not that much of a paladin player that I'm personally outraged by that, but it's something to consider. like, what happens to edge cases like the Warlock, who you can have a Hexblade Warlock who's stabbing people with swords, but doing damage magically, and you can have...
Or weapon-packed gunslinger Warlocks are a thing. They were mm-hmm. there before gunslingers were created.
Yeah. You can do a whole bunch of different stuff with a combination of spells and damage. It makes Gish classes like the Eldritch Knight or the Arcane Trickster, like, this could affect them. And now, it is worth considering how it will do so.
And I think that goes back to what we originally started talking about at the beginning of the conversation about 1D&D. Hey, I did it right this time. If you're letting players customize their class and their player character experience as much as you are, something like this, I think, becomes potentially a limiting factor. So, like, I think it needs to be looked at, unless you're giving those spellcasting players something extra or special to compensate. I don't see this being a rule that I would potentially use myself, even if it makes it to live.
I mean, I think, everyone should have choices in combat. You want to have interesting choices. And, of course, some of those, like y'all pointed out, can be added by encounter design. But some of them are certainly added by class and subclass, and some classes have more of that than others. And I do feel like particularly the physical classes have fewer.
Which, like, is fine for some of them. Like, quite frankly, yeah. If I'm playing a barbarian, I don't want to have to, like, I want to hit it with my axe. Okay. Roll a die. Doom. Did it. Roll the 20. Critical. More dice. You know, I like the fact that the barbarian isn't, I'm going to attack you 6 times. It's like, I'm going to hit you once and then you're going to fall down, because that's what I do. That's my thing. But yeah, it absolutely is the case that, you know, there's a lot of sameness. Like you pointed out with your bow, you're just basically just, okay, I'm going to shoot him. Twink. Okay. Shot him again.
Now I can at least assure you that I've designed an encounter where that's not necessarily the only thing you need to worry about, Liz.
I mean, one thing I can do as a rogue is you do have spells that modify your bow attacks in different ways. But as a ranger, I have a very limited number of spell slots, and usually I fire up, aimed Hunter's Mark. Is it Hunter's Mark or aimed shot?
Hunter's Mark.
Hunter's Mark. Yeah. I fire up Hunter's Mark because that's just extra base damage and done. That's always attack.
Yep.
Yeah, that's always useful. That's always valuable. And there are other spells I could take. Like, I could take Zephyr Strike, which, while it's active for 60 seconds. I believe it's 60 seconds. I could move without provoking opportunity attacks. And that could be something really useful for a ranged character who gets into a melee. You're just like, nope, I'm noping out of this. No, you can't hit me because I'm fast like the wind. But it's like, I don't have that spell because that is a situationally useless spell. And Hunter's Mark is just really reliable all the time. And I can't mix and match those spells. I've got to choose one or the other. And I have to choose. Rangers also don't prepare spells every day. I pick spells, and those are the spells I have forever. So there are several limiting factors that prevent me from saying, okay, this turn I'm going to do this kind of thing. This turn I'm going to do this kind of thing. I can't switch out types of shots every round because I don't have the spell slots. And I have to choose my spells, and then they never change again. And that's both of those things are limiting. So that reduces the choices you make.
So, I mean, I think at the end of the day, what we're all saying is more player choice is more gooder.
Yeah.
Yep.
Also, I can feel this cringing at that.
We should probably at this point wrap it up, because Liz at this point only has half an hour to go watch Critical Role.
I know. And are you caught up with Critical Role, Matt?
I know what happened. Yeah, I watched
it. Okay. Yeah.
I always watch it when it comes out on YouTube, because it's just easier for me to, like, okay, I'm going to skip the ads and so forth.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't have to pay focused attention for like 4 or 5 hours, which is
that's a
difficult.
Bit much for me at this age.
Yeah.
Shiny things distract me.
Except I have to know what happens.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Definitely. I must know.
So yeah,
I'm going to watch it live.
So let's wrap it up, I guess. So Liz can go do that. So I can get food.
Absolutely.
Both of these things, all of these are good ideas. I do want to point out that this is only like the first round of playtesting. This is not the only playtest content we'll get.
We haven't even seen classes. We haven't seen
And we know that they're responsive to feedback. They've been very responsive. We literally just talked about it at the top of the show. So, you know, play the stuff
and
give your opinions.
Classes could you know, address a lot of the things we're talking about that we've been talking about right here. Mm-hmm. That could, there could be so many game changers still to come that we do not know about yet. So I am looking forward to what is next.
Agreed, as am I, because I'm interested in what this Eternal format is going to be, especially with the embracing of the digital tools. We didn't even talk about how D&D Beyond is now owned by Wizards of the Coast and will be leveraged as a digital tool set, and how they're trying to integrate that with the next version of everything that's coming out. There's a lot going on. There's a lot of stuff to talk about, and we'll definitely cover it in the future. But I do want to thank everybody, because podcasts like this and Blizzard Watch is made possible due to your generous contributions at patreon.com/blizzardwatch. Your continued support means this podcast citing community is able to thrive and grow. Blizzard Watch supporters enjoy exclusive benefits like early access to the podcast, better chance of having your question answered on our podcast or the queue, and an ad-free site experience. Again, thank you very much for joining us for this. Matt, Liz, thank you very, very much. I always appreciate talking tabletop with you both.
It's always a good time.
We are good. Good thing happened good.
That's what a natural 20 looks like when Matt rolls it on socials. All right.
Natural 20, natural 1. Who can say?
But thank you very much, folks. We'll see you next time.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien Podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.